Welcome to the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs. My name is Susan Giffen and I will be your moderator for today's session. Special mention must be made of the partners of SACPA, the University of Lethbridge, the Lethbridge Herald, Shaw Cable, and of course Ericsson's, who provide such a lovely lunch for us every day. And I just wanted to say to all of you out there in the viewing audience, I've been away from Lethbridge for the last 3 weeks and I've missed my fix of political or whatever discussion that we have at SACPA. And those of you at home, I really would encourage you to come one day and join us. The lunch is always lovely, and you miss a lot by not being here for the discussion at table while we're eating those lovely sandwiches. So that's an invitation you can consider. Please remember that the cost of this meeting is $8. There's a basket on the table, and Diane is going to come around a little later and collect the money from the basket. The speaker today is Tanis Fiss, and it's very exciting because some of the talk that Tanis is going to give today had a little preamble in the newspaper today on the urban reserve issue. So we're really looking forward to hearing a little bit about that from the Canadian Taxpayer Federation's point of view. Tanis is the director of the Centre for Aboriginal Policy Change with the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. The Canadian Taxpayers Federation is a federally incorporated, nonpartisan citizen advocacy group dedicated to lower taxes, less waste, and accountable government. The Centre for Aboriginal Policy is dedicated solely to examining current Aboriginal policy and court decisions from the perspective of those, Native and non-Native, who will pay the bill, the taxpayers. Tanis Fiss has presented before the House of Commons Standing Committee on Aboriginal Affairs and the Senate Committee for Aboriginal Peoples. She has also met with the Assembly of First Nations Chief Phil Fontaine and presented before the 2004 Aboriginal Forum. And so we would like to welcome Tanis Fiss. Tanis?
I'd like to thank everybody for coming out to the luncheon today and for inviting me to come down here from Calgary to give a talk about Aboriginal policy in Canada. I'll briefly explain what the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is all about and how we came to have an Aboriginal division. The CTF was actually formed roughly 15 years ago in 1990 as a result of the Mulroney government implementing the GST. We formed a tax advocacy organization known as the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Our head office is actually located in Regina, Saskatchewan. We have offices in all the provincial capitals from Ontario West to Victoria. We have a federal office in Ottawa, and we have the Aboriginal Division located in Calgary, Alberta. And as Susan pointed out in her introduction, the Canadian Taxpayers Federation fights for lower taxes, more accountable government, and less waste, which given with what's been going on in Ottawa these days, as well as in Edmonton, I think the Canadian Taxpayers Federation will be around for quite some time fighting for those things for us all. About 5 years ago, the supporters of the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, which is roughly 72,000 across Canada right now, wanted us to concentrate on Aboriginal issues. The bulk of our supporters actually come from the Prairie provinces, where Aboriginal issues have always been more talked about, debated, and discussed than other parts of Canada. And it was actually supporter-driven, and it is definitely supporter-financed, that we created the Centre for Aboriginal Policy Change in 2002. In those almost 4 years now, we've seen quite a lot of movement and discussion on Aboriginal affairs, which I am quite pleased with. Later this year, in November, there will be a Aboriginal roundtable where the leaders of the five main Aboriginal groups will be meeting with the caucus to discuss various issues. And one of the issues that has actually made the agenda is to increase private property rights on native reserves, which is something that the CTF has been advocating for almost 10 years now. So we're quite pleased that it's actually making a national agenda that it's even going to be discussed about. So I'm here to talk about our latest study
which is Road to Prosperity. And I will touch on urban reserves because as I mingled in the room, a lot of people were asking questions about that. But for now, I'll discuss the five recommendations in the Road to Prosperity. In the past, the Center for Aboriginal Policy Change has come up with very high-level recommendations for Aboriginal policy in Canada, namely eventually phasing out the Indian Act, phasing out the Department of Indian Affairs, and eventually phasing out the current reserve system as it is known in Canada. Now, obviously, those three recommendations are going to take some time, probably a couple decades, if we ever actually see those recommendations truly implemented. So in our latest study, Road to Prosperity, we have five recommendations which all they take to implement is legislative change, because it's the Indian Act that is the piece of legislation that actually governs what happens within Native communities. That's the main top law. Currently, Native communities are mainly funded. Roughly 80% of their funding comes from federal transfer payments, and 20% on average is actually owned resource revenue or revenue that the communities generate themselves. Of the money that is transferred from Ottawa to the Native communities, it goes directly to the chief and council to disperse within their communities. It's the chief and council who decides how much money is going to be spent on housing, education, social services, welfare, et cetera, essentially everything that the community needs to operate. Regrettably, and even the Department of Indian and Northern Affairs admits that there is a lack of accountability and transparency, and there's a huge lack of being able to track where this money is being spent and how it's being spent. So what we're recommending is, rather than transfer the money directly to the chief and council, actually transfer that money to the Native Canadian individuals who comprise these communities, and actually have the chief and council tax the money back that they need to use to operate the community. That action in and of itself will increase accountability and transparency, because whenever you directly see money taken away from you and used within your community, that instills personal responsibility, and the community members will actually ask for greater accountability and transparency within their communities. I'm pleased to say that we do have support from a few Aboriginal groups, mainly in the Manitoba region. The First Nations National Accountability Coalition agrees with this particular recommendation, as does Jean Allard, who is a Métis activist who is also in the Manitoba region. Our second recommendation has to do with the Auditor General of Canada. As I mentioned, it's extremely difficult to find out how the money is spent within Native communities, even though Native communities are responsible for producing a large number of reports for the Department of Indian Affairs. Regrettably, the bulk of these reports just sit in a file room in the Department of Indian Affairs, and they're never actually utilized to evaluate the effectiveness of the various programs. And the Auditor General of Canada is not able to actually investigate and evaluate and audit these various programs, because it's the Indian Act which is the ultimate piece of legislation. And what we're advocating for is for the mandate of the Auditor General to be expanded to include Native communities, so that we can actually determine if the money is going where it's intended to go, if the programs and services are truly effective and efficient. Because if we're just throwing good money after bad on a program or a services that isn't meeting the needs of the community, then why do we have this particular program and services? And there might be some great programs and services in the Maritimes that could be used in the prairies or in Western Canada and vice versa, but we don't know because we can't actually audit this material. And given that it's a large chunk of tax dollars that is being spent each year on Aboriginal affairs, roughly $8 billion a year federally, Canadian taxpayers do deserve to know how and where the money is being spent, as Native Canadians deserve to know how the money is being spent within their own community. Right now, because the Indian Act is the main legislation that governs what happens on reserves, if there's a Native Canadian that believes that his or her band council is corrupt, or there's a history of nepotism or mismanagement, and this individual actually goes to seek redress from his or her band council, quite often they're turned away. The door is essentially shut on their face. And if this individual then goes to the Department of Indian and Northern Affairs to seek redress, the department says, not our issue, it's a band issue, go deal with that within your own community. So here we have individuals that are caught between a rock and a hard place. They believe that their band council is mismanaging the funds. There might be fraud, corruption. Even the Department of Indian Affairs 2 years ago actually recorded over 300 cases where Native Canadians went and complained to the department about various allegations of corruption and mismanagement within their communities. But there's no place for these people to go to seek redress. So what we're advocating is for the creation of an ombudsman for Aboriginal affairs that would truly be independent of both the band councils and the Department of Indian Affairs and would investigate complaints at either the band level or at the department level, because it's a two-way street and the light of accountability and transparency seriously needs to be shed on these particular areas, because these are citizens, they're paying taxes too within their local communities quite often. They deserve to have accountability and transparency too. And if there is truly an independent ombudsman that reports directly to the parliament, that has some teeth, that can have the RCMP investigate various complaints, hopefully we would see the allegations reduce with time. Currently, on reserves, the land which actually comprises the reserve is actually held in trust by the Crown, or Ottawa, hence why there's an Indian Act that essentially governs what happens within the community. Native Canadians can, under the Indian Act, own the roof over their head. There's a provision within the Indian Act known as the Certificate of Possession. Now, they'll never be able to own the land under their feet in fee simple, as other Canadians do off reserve, because the land is held in trust by the Crown. However, owning the roof over your head empowers individuals. We've seen this the world over. So the Canadian Taxpayers Federation is advocating for better utilization of certificates of possession. Now, certificates of possession are like out-and-out ownership of your home. You can mortgage the home on the reserve from a traditional banking institution. So a Native Canadian can shop for the best mortgage for his or her need, or they can actually get it from their band council or CMHC. So there are options for financing available. Once the mortgage is paid for, the individual owns their home, just like any other Canadian does. A band cannot say you no longer own it. It actually has to be sold, subdivided, left to an heir or something. It is true ownership. And what we've seen across Canada is the Native communities that embrace the use of certificates of possession tend to be the most prosperous. Because, of course, if you own the roof over your head, you can invest, you can renovate in it, you take care of it, you can leave it to your kids, so assets build up with time. Therefore, there's wealth and there's prosperity. The Six Nations Reserve in Canada is the most populous reserve. It's actually located in Ontario. There's roughly over 22,000 members within this community, and the Six Nations Reserve actually has their own internal real estate market because they've actually issued over 10,000 certificates of possession. And this is actually really adding to their economy. And in the short term, because the band council is still getting federal money for housing, that money can be used in the community for other things. It can be used in the areas of community development, economic development, or whatever. So it actually keeps more money within the community when people own their own homes. And the final recommendation that we have in Road to Prosperity is the issue about matrimonial property rights on reserves. As I have mentioned repeatedly, it's the Indian Act, which is the piece of legislation, and like any piece of legislation, it can be amended. The Indian Act is completely mute and silent on the issue of matrimonial property rights. It's currently up to the chief and council to decide who gets what in a divorce or a common law situation, even when, regrettably, there's domestic violence that's taking place. It's up to the chief and council to decide who gets to remain in the family home, any child support that may be paid, if any, and child custody. Now, clearly this can't keep taking place. I mean, not too long ago, Canadians were jumping up and down about the idea of Sharia law in Ontario, which the Premier of Ontario, Dalton McGuinty, struck down because they thought it was too archaic. Yet here we are in Canada, there are Aboriginal women and children on reserves who don't have basic matrimonial property rights. And that's been going on for some time. And there have been many Aboriginal women's organizations that have come to the Canadian Taxpayers Federation and said, can you shine more light on this? So what we're advocating at the CTF is, because the Indian Act can be easily amended, it just takes, Parliament to change it, to open the Indian Act up so that the appropriate provincial family law would apply to Native communities. Provincial family law, it isn't perfect, but it's well understood across Canada as to what happens in a divorce, what happens with custody and access and child support, and this should be opened up to Aboriginal women and children, because study after study, whether it's a Canadian sanctioned report or a report by the United Nations, clearly Aboriginal women and children living on reserves are the most disadvantaged Canadians of all. And I personally have a great deal of passion over this particular issue and would like to see this happen. The recommendations that I've listed, the reallocation of the funding, the Ombudsman for Aboriginal Affairs, the expanding the mandate to Auditor General, utilizing certificates of possession, and the matrimonial property rights can all be done with simple amendments or just better utilizing the Indian Act as it is today. And all it takes is political will in order to do it. And I am grateful that Canadians are now openly starting to discuss the issue of Aboriginal affairs in Canada, so I'm very hopeful that this will come. I know that there's a lot of questions out there about urban reserves, and I don't really know how you want me to tackle that. As I said in our recommendation, or in my opening, that the Canadian Taxpayers Federation would like to see the Indian Act, the Department of Indian Affairs, and eventually the reserve system phased out over time. So we're not in support of creating new reserves, because reserves are, whether they're located in an urban center, a rural center, they're always under the Indian Act and all the handcuffs that go with the Indian Act, where there's a section that businesses doing business with reserve businesses, there's nothing to attach to have a lien or garnishee with, because as I mentioned, the land which comprises an Indian reserve is actually held in trust by the Crown / Ottawa. So there's nothing, if you are owed money from a Native community, that you can do. So that's a huge block, unfortunately, that actually scares away a lot of investors. And if investors do decide to invest, or an accountant decides to work for a Native community, a lawyer, regrettably, they end up charging more money as a risk premium to balance out the risk of non-payment. And so clearly Native Canadians aren't winning on that regard either. And then the biggest friction that I've seen across Canada with regards to urban reserves is the tax exemption, because Native reserves are under the Indian Act, and the Indian Act exempts these communities from taxation. But there is taxation within the communities themselves. Quite often there's the sin taxes or some sort of property tax within the community that stays there that are different throughout Canada. I know there's probably specific questions. I think we're supposed to break for lunch now, so you think about your questions about what I said and about urban reserves, and I'll be happy to try and answer them for you. So I think now there's lunch. Thank you.